Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with an internet challenge, Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim joins us by phone today since the internet in his neighborhood is still suffering some issues in the wake of Hurricane Irene. But we still have good news, bad news, and crazy news for conservatives. And quite frankly, all these stories could be considered crazy, certainly the second and third. But let's start with the good martini today. And it's another bit of a great news from Gallup, at least at this point in the season. And it shows that the president's job approval rating is at an all-time low, 41% among women. And Jim, I think if folks had said men or people whose number one issue was the economy or something like that. But the president has got to have women, particularly, you know, the suburban soccer mom types, as the conventional wisdom goes. If they're hovering around 40%, he's in a world of hurt, obviously a long time to go. But even the people who seemed to be most enamored with Obama 3 years ago are pretty fed up with him, it seems like, at this point.
Greg, I think it's very revealing that when you said, hey, for the good martini, let's talk about the bad poll numbers for Obama, and I was absolutely convinced you meant the latest numbers from Quinnipiac, not Gallup, which are also bad. His approval rating is at its height at its low for 42%. The disapproval rating is all the way up to 52%, and it's funny you mentioned women, because now with women, he's under a quarter there, 44% approval, 49% disapproval. Pretty surprised, of course, you know, bad amongst independents, bad amongst men, et cetera, et cetera. So Quinnipiac and Gallup are kind of reinforcing each other today and kind of saying, no, we're there, you know, with a few points difference here and there, they're finding a very glum picture for the president. This will tie very well into our bad martini. I just kind of wonder if this August has seen some sort of tipping point. And it's kind of interesting. In a way, it's not as dramatic as some things, but perhaps the debt ceiling fight, the downgrading of the credit rating. I think even you could argue the Martha's Vineyard vacation, that it just doesn't help very much. And now the idea, well, here comes the big jobs plan. Boy, it better be swell, Mr. President. You know, the fact that really nobody expects anything significant to come out of this. I don't want to jump ahead too much to the other martini, but this is a president who does not seem to be full of fantastic new ideas that are going to completely change the dynamic of the political environment between now and Election Day 2012.
Yeah, and it's a precipitous drop. You mentioned there could be a tipping point or a turning point just in this past month of August, but the president has dropped, according to Gallup, 11 points since May, 52 to 41% just among women, and things are definitely not heading in the right direction for him. But it shows that more and more people, and this is why it's good, not just that the president's numbers are in the tank, that more and more people are understanding that his approach to dealing with the biggest issues facing this country not only are failing, but have failed, and that makes his challenge even greater when he gives this speech next week, which is a good transition into martini number two, Jim, and that, of course, is the president's call. We talked about it just a little over a week ago, where he said it's time to put the country ahead of politics, and in that light, he decided to request a joint session of Congress so he could speak about jobs at the exact hour that the Republican presidential candidates are expected to duke it out at the Reagan Library out in California. He announced this to the media before ever requesting it from the speaker, who then shot back saying, look, we're not even going to be back in session until a couple hours before that. We can't do a security sweep. And so, you know, this needs to be pushed back a day, which now this is good on a number of fronts, even though it's bad for the country that the president's doing this. First of all, Boehner looks stronger than Obama. The liberal left is going to be furious that Obama supposedly caved again. And, of course, the president's now competing with the Packers and Saints, which is probably more interesting to most Americans anyway, considering that they've heard this speech about 15 times before. So the president tried to play a political power play here, and it clearly failed at a time exactly when Americans don't want to see that.
Ironically, you know, the president could start his speech at 7 o'clock and have it done by the 8:30 kickoff if he wanted to. He could, you know, only speak for half an hour. I know it's probably considered unthinkable, but there's really no reason that says you have to speak for an hour and a half or however long the president is expected to speak. I had suggested that he speak at the halftime of the game. You know, that'd be even shorter, but I think it certainly would maximize the attention. Also, the compromise I had floated yesterday was that Obama gets to speak on Wednesday night, but the three Republicans are at the bottom of the screen in silhouette like Mystery Science Theater 3000, and they get to comment during the speech. That proposal was not accepted here. But the reason I said it's a bad martini, even though it's, you know, probably Boehner's feeling pretty good about himself this morning, is that we've been kind of saying, you know, all right, what's Obama going to do on jobs for months and months and months now? Ever since the debt ceiling fight, Obama said, oh, I'm going to have a very specific plan, and don't you, you know, worry, this plan is coming. And I just had a picture Axelrod and Obama and Bill Daley and maybe all these, maybe Carney, all these guys sitting around the table and saying, ha, boy, we really showed the president. We really showed those Republicans. We're going to make them move their presidential debate. And I wonder if there's just some intern in the back of the room who'd say, now what? They're like, okay, you made the Republicans move their debate. Suppose this had worked out the way they went. Then what? You know, it's not like nobody's going to watch the Republican debate anyway. The president still needs to give a job speech. And, you know, I think you and I feel like we probably can predict a bunch of what's going to be said. I inherited this problem, green jobs, high-speed rail, win the future. We can't afford not to invest in blah, 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 blah. You know, I mean, we've heard all this stuff before. So why he's doing this brinksmanship and why they're hyping the speech and why they want it before Congress, when the possibility is that this is going to be a lot of, you know, reheated leftovers of past Obama speeches, it doesn't strike me as, you know, as long-term smart for the president. And a lot of people would say, why are you expecting that from this president? But nonetheless, it just seems like there's almost a flailing short-term strategy here that is, while it's bad for Obama's reelection prospect, the idea of a president who is just panicking and responding politically to everything for the next 16 months or so is really not that reassuring for the fate of the country. So even though it's probably good for Republicans, this whole debacle over scheduling the speech indicates that this president is only focused on one thing, and that means there's probably going to be no improvement in the jobs picture for the next, you know, year and a quarter.
Yeah, why he couldn't deliver a primetime address from the White House on Tuesday, for example, is beyond me. He just wants this theater, I think, where he can look so much more imposing and above it all when he's trying to lecture, particularly House Republicans. I think that's the atmosphere he's going for, and in an atmosphere usually reserved for, you know, post 9/11 declarations of war, that sort of thing. He's trying to use this now as a common trick, since he used it for the healthcare debate as well. I don't think any president's ever used non-State of the Union speeches twice for policy speeches. It just smacks of somebody who just can't get enough of himself.
At least in recent memory, we know George W. Bush did it once on the eve of the Iraq War, and we know that Bill Clinton did it once when he was making his pitch for healthcare. So it's not that common. I just think the other thing is that the idea of Obama needing to, I suppose the argument, well, he's making up a plan to Congress, so he wants to address it to Congress. He wants to look them in the eye and say, pass these ideas. It was kind of interesting to see the number of folks on the left, including like Roland Martin, not my favorite commentator, come out and say, you know, Obama should be giving this speech in a city where unemployment is extremely high, and he should do a Q&A with unemployed voters. And, you know, that's actually a terrific idea. So it's one of those weird days when I say, good job, Roland Martin. But I mean, the idea that this, even liberals can kind of see, you know what, I don't really understand why he needs to do a rehash of a State of the Union style address when, you know, the audience he needs to reassure is well beyond the halls of Congress. And that is, you know, that's really where he needs to show a country that that he's got some ideas on this jobs front. I got to be honest, you know, we'll see what happens next Thursday night, but not really all that optimistic that we're going to see anything all that surprising or different or dramatic from the president.
Now, very quickly, on to number three now. And you mentioned, Jim, we can expect to hear about investing in clean energy and green jobs and so forth. We probably won't hear the word Solyndra in that speech, because this is a firm out in Fremont, California, that the president had touted as the future of U.S. energy and how we can create green jobs and win the future and put people back to work, yada, yada, yada. Well, things aren't going so well at Solyndra. They're about to lay off 1,100 people, and this after over $500 million in taxpayer money from the Department of Energy was funneled into this place to prop it up to make it look like it was a success in bringing back the economy. Probably not the timing the president was hoping for. It's not funny. It's not crazy for the people who work there. They're unfortunately going to be losing their jobs. But it's once again crazy to think that this is the answer to our economic situation.
Yeah, as I put it in the Morning Jolt this morning, Solyndra Green doesn't employ people. They don't employ people. In honor of the Soylent Green climax, it's depressing. I think, but for those of us in the political realm, what's kind of significant is that this is kind of the heart of the Obama approach to the world. And he had visited this factory in spring of 2010. He said, this is, you know, a symbol of American promise. This is a testament to American ingenuity and dynamism. And besides the symbolism of a company that, you know, Obama is touting to the heavens, you know, going, look, everyone loves green jobs in theory. Everybody loves innovative technology, all these things. But if these are really fantastic ideas, at some point you figure, well, why are there no private investors? Why does no one believe in this? No one, why is nobody else willing to put their money into this? And sometimes there are times where you can finance some basic R&D and it pays down the road, et cetera. But everyone has, a good suspicion of government investment in particular businesses to promote particular ends. The fear of cronyism, I think, will not surprise anyone to learn that the majority owner was a big fundraiser for the Obama campaign. And so we're just left in this circumstance in which what did taxpayers get for the $500 million they put into this? What was the payoff? What was the result? In the end, what did this company do? And if the whole idea was that they were, you know, creating a product that there was never going to be a market for, or was never going to be cost-effective, or was never going to be profitable, why did we do this? And I think that's something the president is really going to have to address at some point, if he ever got asked about it, of course, and if he ever, you know, thought about these things other than in the, you know, most generalized terms.
Just another example of the government trying to force something down our throats when the market simply doesn't have a demand for it, as you mentioned. Jim, it'll be very interesting to see what other political wrangling happens between now and the debate and the speech, but we'll be all over it. Have a great day.
Greg, I look forward to sending you my thoughts by carrier pigeon tomorrow.
Jim Carrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Friday for the next Three Martini Lunch.